Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Relay Bitcoin podcast. Today, in a very special environment with a very special guest, I'm looking forward to this session. We are here in Zurich, actually, in a new studio that is very close to our old office at House of Satoshi at Langstrasse. So it's super nice, super well set up, way better than usual, because we have a special occasion today to talk with Richard Byworth in person here in Zurich about the fiat-based monetary system and all that kind of stuff, but also obviously the Bitcoin financial system. There's not a lot of people that have so much experience in the traditional and also the Bitcoin-based financial system like you. I'm really happy to have you here, Richard Byworth. Maybe quickly introduce yourself, because you're not like a well-known figure, I would say. You should be well-known, but you are not. I think that's also on purpose. So please tell us a little bit about yourself.
Sure. Thanks, Julian. I started my career as an investment banker in London. I was a trader, and then I moved into sales and moved to Tokyo with the Japanese investment bank Nomura. I actually did first hear about Bitcoin on the trading desk in Tokyo in 2009. When one of my young grads started talking about Bitcoin. He's retired now.
With 31.
Exactly. And then I moved to Hong Kong after we acquired Lehman Brothers in Asia. And I continued my career in banking till about 2017, at which point the draw of crypto became very intense. It was becoming very interesting. But it was about time for me to leave my traditional banking career. And I stepped out. I joined a Bitcoin mining company that wanted to move into finance involving crypto. And one of the products that we built, first and foremost, was a fund of hedge funds. That was with the company Diginex, which later became Equinix. We listed the company on NASDAQ. Ended up being like 250 people. Essentially went down the path of selling the company to Binance. At that point, I stepped down and decided to take some time off, and that's where we met in the first instance in Switzerland. And in March of 22, I started talking to a Swiss bank called Cees, the alternative asset management arm of Cees, which is Cees Capital. And I now look after all of the hedge fund business for them. And one of the core projects is to help them launch a fund of crypto hedge funds. So we're in process with that. We've partnered with a group called CMCC Global, which is a crypto fund out of Hong Kong. And really what we want to try and do is bring the traditional hedge fund selection capabilities of Cees. We've been doing it for 27 years. And combine that with the sort of oversight that you need in the crypto community to make sure that you're not running into an FTX problem or any other. Really, we're trying to make sure that we provide a product that is all weather. We can talk about what some of this terminology might mean, but the idea in traditional finance that you can build uncorrelated returns is very interesting. That's what we do across all products at Cees Capital. And we feel very strongly that you can do that with crypto. So, in a year like 2022, when things went horribly wrong for crypto, there are alpha strategies that you can be employing to actually make money in a year like that. And that's really where we're focused and what really became the genesis of the product.
Interesting. That's so interesting. A lot to unpack there. But what would be interesting for me, obviously, as an entrepreneur, is like how... With Equinix, you were involved in the founding and the building up of this. Was it an exchange or what kind of?
So we started off as a miner. We then sold the mining business, used the proceeds of that to start to build out the fund that I mentioned. So we actually launched a fund in 2019. We launched an exchange because we realized that all the exchanges that these funds were operating on weren't institutional and. Mm-hmm. Really, we were quite uncomfortable with our funds running money on these exchanges. Mm-hmm. And then the other problem was custody. Many of these crypto custodians had problems, had been hacked before, didn't have what we would refer to as sort of institutional grade standards. That's all changing now. You've got specifically custodians. You've got really some very credible players coming into the space, but also, you know, companies like Coinbase are starting to roll out much more traditional finance looking solutions like Coinbase Prime. So that's where you can have all your coins custody with Coinbase, but then actually operate on 7 or 8 different exchanges that they offer through that solution. So, but you're never actually putting your coins there. It's Coinbase that's taking the risk. And so you have credit risk to Coinbase and none of the others. So we're starting to see an institutionalization of the space as a whole. And I think that it's really important when you're looking at, as I mentioned before, those sort of alpha type strategies where you can make money in any environment. You want to make sure that you're not going to have something blow up in your face that you're not expecting, like an FTX type situation.
And even banking situations like, you know, Silvergate and Silicon Valley Bank and stuff like that. But what was interesting about your case then for Binance? Why did they want to, you know, buy you? And did they end up like buying you? What was the process like?
So, yeah, it all started in September 21. I stepped down in December just because I didn't agree with the process. And I didn't think it was going to go ahead. And Binance, unfortunately, didn't go ahead with it a year later. But they did really spend a lot of time making sure that they understood everything about the company. The thing they were interested in was the licenses. And for them to get regulated in places like the UK, where they've been kicked out, Singapore, where they've been kicked out. These are all places where we had either licenses or in process of licenses with regulators. Okay. So that was why they cared.
Interesting. So it would have been a good deal if you stayed, right?
It didn't stay. Yeah, look, I think if they'd done the deal and gone ahead with it, The biggest problem was that I think that you can't just buy a regulated entity and say, okay, we're regulated now, because that's not how regulation works. The problem was the regulators would always have to approve Binance. And I think that's where the problem came.
And why did you then, so you took some time out and you wanted to get back, right? I mean, you could also probably have retired after like all these years in hedge fund business, and you know, you're probably a good money manager, so you could also retire. What was the motivation to get back to work, and why? Because I know how enthusiastic you are in Bitcoin. Why did you work like in a Bitcoin only or whatever company? Why did you decide to go back into like a hedge fund asset management kind of setup?
So for me, I'm a Bitcoin maxi like you and like many who've studied this space long enough to understand that this is the core technology and this is the core solution. That is the whole crypto industry. But for me, it was really about, you know, how do I expand and continue to grow what I'm doing? I think in my personal time, I spend a lot of time helping people understand Bitcoin. But for me, what I really wanted to make sure was that we had a product that was institutional, which was what I'd always wanted to build from the very beginning. Now, with the previous fund that I launched, and we had for 3 years, decent track record, we made 90% net over that period for our investors. But we made a few mistakes. And one of the mistakes was that we wanted to always have a little bit of directionality in the portfolio. Now, that can cause you problems in a year like 2022, even if it's not very big. So what we want to have is flexibility within the portfolio to change that directionality. And so part of the partnership with CMCC Global was with another Bitcoin maximalist, a guy called Willie Wu, who you probably know quite well. So Willie is a partner and part of the investment committee on the fund. So, yeah, I mean, speaking to Willie pretty much every day now about how we're thinking about positioning the portfolio in terms of directionality. But we have very key limits about what we can do. So the idea is that in a year like 2022, you're running zero directionality. It was fairly clear by March that we were going to have problems if you were, as Willie does, analyzing things on chain. And for people that are listening that might not know Willie, I assume most of them do because this is a Bitcoin podcast, but Willie was the pioneer of what's referred to today as on-chain analysis. And so that really is quite a core discipline now in Bitcoin. Obviously with Chainalysis, you know, doing work with people like the FBI, you know, this has now become a very key way for people to look at the blockchain. It's very different, obviously, to any other asset class.
Mm.
So it adds an interesting tilt to the asset class to be able to say, I've got this whole swathe of data. I can literally analyze any transaction and start to see patterns, which is what Willie's been doing for the last 12 years now, to be able to say, you know, these are various different macro indicators that I'd look at to be able to see where we are in a cycle and mm-hmm. what's the strength of that cycle. And so as we see the cycle strength really get stronger and stronger, the idea is to be adding directionality more and more to the portfolio. So we have grades of 0% directionality, 7.5%, 15%, and 30%. And just, you know, this product is a fund of crypto hedge funds. So we are investing our capital or our investors' capital in other hedge funds. So the idea is that we're putting a portfolio together of a number of different strategies that allow us to really carve out the different pockets of alpha that we see as being available in the crypto asset class.
Hey everyone, this is Anna from Relay. I want to tell you about Relay Private. It's our exclusive service for private clients, family offices, and small or medium-sized companies looking to buy or sell large amounts of Bitcoin. As a Relay Private client, you have a full team focusing on your needs. A dedicated account manager guides you every step of the way. You also get personalized 24/7 support and gain access to exclusive reports and industry insights created by Relay. If that sounds like something you or somebody you know should check out, click the link in the description or head over to relay.app/private.
Is this also how you think the actual real big money, the real big institutional money is coming in? Because they obviously don't want to build the whole capabilities of, oh, should I invest? In which coins should I invest? Should I hold it myself? Or I need to find a good custodian for it. Like, and as you said, different cycles require different strategies. And so they probably, if you're a huge fund or asset manager managing billions, you probably don't want to allocate 100, 200, 300 million to something like that, like a diversified fund of fund that is doing the job, right? Is this how you envision like the real big money coming in?
When you think about institutional investors, they size the position in their portfolio based on the volatility of that position, right? So something like a direct investment in Bitcoin is only going to ever be very small in the portfolio at this point in its life with the volatility that it's showing.
Mm.
So a fund like this where we can temper the volatility and actually really be very focused on drawdowns. So when we do our selection process, I mean, Willie's absolutely adamant about it every time we speak. So like, see a fund with more than 2% drawdown in a month ever, like, I really don't want to look at this. So,
and that's hard to do in the crypto market, right?
Exactly. So this is why we're very focused on what we call these market neutral strategies. So To take an example, it'd be someone who's doing short-term over-collateralized lending on some of these platforms. It could be cross-exchange arbitrage, which the ability to do that arbitrage has really been limited since probably around 2017-18, but we do occasionally see these events where massive trades go through. And a good example of this was in 2021 on Kraken. I don't know if you remember it, but Ethereum, someone fat-fingered an Ethereum trade of $40 million to sell at 700 when Ethereum was trading at 1400. And so this moment, you know, obviously no one's got $40 million just kicking around on Kraken because there's so many different exchanges. So it's really this race by the market makers and these funds to get as many dollars onto Kraken as you could, as quickly as you could, so that you could be buying up that ETH significantly discounted and then selling it out elsewhere. It's kind of these sorts of trades. It's, you know, spot underlying Bitcoin versus any kind of derivative in Bitcoin. As we move into bull cycles, you get much more expansion of the premium, so the basis between a derivative market and the underlying spot market. So again, an example in March 2021, when everybody wanted to be buying crypto, Bitcoin perpetual futures gapped out on the basis to about 80% IRR. So, the returns on a risk-free basis or a market-neutral basis, as we call it, so you're not taking any market risk.
Mm.
Bitcoin goes up, down, the premium is still the same, right? Mm-hmm. You're just moving up and down because you're short one, long the other, you're moving up and down.
Mm-hmm.
These are the sorts of trades where we call them market-neutral, right? So you're not taking any directional risk, which means Bitcoin can crash, 50%, you're still... You can walk away from the trade and be like, I've got no market risk on the table. I think that's a really critical piece about what we're doing. And that comes back to your question around institutions, because institutions do really think about the volatility and if you can smooth out that volatility and probably sacrifice some of the upside in a bull market, but make sure that you're never, having some of the downside volatility in the bear market that is so violent. Then you can build a product that actually starts to really attract institutions and create that next leg of institutional adoption, which I think is really very key.
And it's even making the whole market more professional, more mature, right? Because you smooth kind of with all these techniques, you smooth out the inefficiencies that still are there. And you take out a bit of the volatility so that the big money is even coming in. You provide more security and more confidence for them to invest their hundreds of millions, right? And in the end, that's very good for Bitcoin and the crypto market in general, right? Mm-hmm. It's kind of one step of growing up, right?
Yeah, look, I think it's really exciting to be able to, like you asked me earlier, why did I want to go and do this? Actually, it's quite exciting to be able to offer a product to an institution where you're like, I'm basically telling you that pigs can fly.
Right? Yeah.
So you can make money in the down market and you can make even more money in the up market. People are like, yeah, okay, fine. Well, get out of my office.
It's a no-brainer.
Yeah. Too good to be true. Yeah. You, when you tell an institutional investor too good to be true, it's often, just that. So what we've done is we've structured the fund in a way that if you come in early, then you get the possibility to continue to come in over years, whether or not there's capacity. Mm-hmm. So what we do is we essentially carve out future capacity for our early investors, but also give them much lower fees.
Okay.
So the idea is, so I'll give you an example. I was sat with an institutional client at lunch the other day, and he's like, well, I want to probably have a 20 million position in this. So I start off with, six or seven. You give me three capacity options or two capacity options. And so then I can get to my $20 million position because you're telling me that pigs can fly. Well, you show me and then I can scale into the position.
Absolutely.
So, that's what I get excited about as an institutional guy, having lived in the institutional world for so long. It is extremely hard to continuously make money. And so when you see something like this and you say, wow, okay, actually there is a pattern here. There are people that are eking out returns in any environment, and we can rotate a little bit more into those that can make more money in a bull market than the guys that make more money in a bear market, then you've got a dynamic portfolio allocation strategy.
Yeah, makes total sense. And so in terms of institutional demand, like I feel like for 6 years now, since 2017, I keep reading from like Mike Novogratz and all these guys, wow, the herd is coming. Like all these institutional demand is now coming. We're on the brink of an ETF and then like billions are flooding in. I feel like this is not really the case, has not been really the case yet. How do you see this evolving, like this institutional demand? Are they still sitting on the sidelines and waiting to get in, or is it kind of slowly but steadily already happening?
I think we are starting to see a shift in the institutional understanding of the fact that there's something with Bitcoin and maybe all the other crypto is really very much gambling. I think that's a very big positive. We want to really see a shift towards Bitcoin, because that's the that's the one cryptocurrency that we know is going to be around in the future. So obviously you've got a lot of work that's been done by Fidelity. They've been doing it since 2015, but they do regular research. Obviously ARK are very vocal about their views around Bitcoin, but obviously you've also got BlackRock now that have got a Bitcoin fund. And I think, just to transition a little bit, the thinking around the conversation, one key thing that has kept institutional investors away for so long has been this ESG negativity. And the fact that, oh, well, you know, you're burning the planet, you're boiling the oceans by mining Bitcoin. And I think the fact that you have a player now like BlackRock that is so focused on ESG,
right,
that has now said, okay, actually, this is something that we can put in our funds. I think that's quite a significant step that probably the community as a whole hasn't necessarily paid attention to.
I feel like, yeah, I mean, this was the biggest news last year in the Bitcoin industry, and it didn't really get, you know, through the public that much. That BlackRock, the biggest asset manager in the world, managing 10 trillions, is now offering actual physical Bitcoin access to institutions. But is it so far just an announcement, or do you think that there's already a lot of volume happening, or why didn't we really see any price movements or any other significant developments out of that?
I think, I mean, again, this is something we talk about a lot when we're running the ICO of the fund. The accumulation that we're seeing on chain is actually very significant, and it's been this way for a long time. If FTX hadn't happened, we'd already be way into a raging bull market. I think FTX just slowed us down. So in a way, as you know, accumulation at lower prices is better. It means that the ramp up later is even stronger. Stack sats every day. Yeah, no, it makes a bigger difference later on. So if FTX hadn't happened, we'd probably be a lot higher now, which means the impact of the dollars in the longer term wouldn't be so great as they're likely to be this time around, or later on in as we approach the halving. So I think, it's extremely positive. As we always say, everything's good for Bitcoin, right?
Yeah, in the end, it is kind of. Maybe it has to do with us being too much in a bubble, but I feel like every news that I read, that's pretty good for Bitcoin.
Yeah.
So what led, in your opinion, what led to this change of like Larry Fink and BlackRock all of a sudden being very positive about Bitcoin when they were clearly not a couple of years ago?
I think it started with the head of fixed income, who's now the CIO of the firm, a guy called Rick Rieder. He's one of the most senior people at BlackRock. I think he'd slowly started having his head turned to Bitcoin. In 2020, he went on CNBC and started talking about, you know, as we saw Tudor Jones, we saw many of these bigger name hedge fund managers come on and say, there's something here. This is a macro trade. And in an inflation environment, you want the fastest horse, to quote Tudor Jones. Bitcoin's potentially the fastest horse. And I think a lot of the guys that were managing a lot of money started to understand and see that. And Rick Rieder was one of them. And so they got approval in 2020 to start trading Bitcoin futures on their fund. And then it just obviously went from there. I mean, Rick's very close to Larry Fink, so, you know, he's eventually gonna turn the head of the big man.
So you think Rick got orange-pilled by someone, maybe it was Michael Saylor or someone,
yeah,
and then Rick orange-pilled or is in the process of orange-pilling Larry?
Yeah, I mean, someone like Larry's going to take a damn long time to get orange-pilled.
Mm-hmm.
He's so institutionalized. Yeah, I mean, I find for that generation, it's really hard to get through the mindset blockage that they have with, obviously, you know, they've come out of the tail end of the Second World War when all these institutions like the IMF and the World Bank were all put in place.
Mm-hmm.
And I was at a barbecue recently here in Switzerland, and there was a 70-year-old lady there, and I got introduced to everyone at the barbecue as the Bitcoin guy. And she said, Christine Lagarde says that Bitcoin's really bad, so, you know,
Must be bad. Obviously
it's really bad.
Yeah. So. Obviously, Christine Lagarde, 67 years old. Of course, she knows about new technologies. That's interesting. Yeah, but, I mean, for example, Michael Saylor is also rather. I actually don't know his age, but he's also rather on the older side.
Yeah, yeah.
But he's still. I mean, he got it not quickly, but quickly enough, well, and then he showed a lot of conviction, right? And I think you also have some connection to Michael Saylor. Didn't you? speak with him and or
well, something. I don't have any connection to him. Yeah. I just basically it was a funny story actually. I ended up at the Bitcoin conference last year with in Miami with a couple of kids from Argentina who were mining Bitcoin in the Northern Territories, and they were talking to me about investing in their company. I was just interested, like, you know, looking at investments for Bitcoin only companies. Obviously, you and I ended up talking on that regard as well. But so they called me and they said, look, we told you this story about us getting the president of Argentina elected. I was like, I didn't believe them at all. I was like, obviously, it's just some of these stories you hear in crypto. And they said, well, wait, we did actually reach the president recently, and it turns out he's in Miami and he wants to come to the conference. Who should he meet? And so I said, well, if there's anybody he should meet, it's Saylor.
Mm-hmm.
And they were like, well, he doesn't know who Saylor is, so can you just look around and see if there's anybody that you can find that he you could arrange some meetings with? So I ran around. I set up some meetings with Jeff Booth and Nick Carter and a couple of other people. And then they called back a few hours later, and they were like, okay, he's researched Saylor. His people have researched Saylor. He wants to meet Saylor. Great. So then I had to run around the conference and find someone that knew Saylor. And so through Scott Melker, who I knew, and he's close with Eric Weiss. Eric Weiss is the guy that orange-pilled Saylor. We ended up that evening introducing the Argentinian former president to Michael Saylor in his beach house in Miami, which was fun.
That sounds like a lot of fun. So you have attended this meeting as well, or have you?
Yeah,
just set it up?
I set it up, and then it was funny because we were sat at the table. It was myself, Saylor, Eric Weiss, and the advisor to the president, and we're sat there, and they all look at me and they go, "Can you introduce everybody?" Oh, sure.
That's so cool. So yeah. For someone like you who has spent the bigger part of his career, like 20, 25 years in traditional finance and this whole financial system and hedge fund and asset management, mm-hmm. and all fiat-based as it gets, right?
Mm-hmm.
What did you see as the biggest problem, or what do you see now as the biggest problem of the fiat-based financial system? Why do you think there needs to be a change towards a decentralized Bitcoin-based financial system?
Yeah, well, I actually in 2008-09 I was living through that with Nomura, and we acquired Lehman Brothers that had obviously famously failed in the crisis, and you know, the solution was print a load of money, basically, and I was, you know, I never studied economics, so I was like, hang on a minute, like surely this is just gonna completely break everything. And I talked to the economist of the firm, the strategist, everybody I could speak to that was, you know, smart enough to be able to explain this in an eloquent way. I was like, are we not just completely devaluing our money and, like, everything is going to go to massive inflation? And nobody could explain to me that this wasn't the case. And even though I'd heard about Bitcoin, I didn't understand the fact, and like many when they first hear about it, they didn't understand that it's a closed system and it's a limited amount of, you know, Bitcoin at 21 million. And so I started buying gold because I was like, we're going to have a failure here of some fiat monies. And then I, in 2017, started really studying Bitcoin again because of a book I read, and they kept talking about Bitcoin as a, you know, as a potential technology in the future, but also as an inflation hedge. And that's obviously something that immediately, you know, triggered me. Inflation and devaluation of money, and particularly, you know, you obviously as a Bitcoiner have heard this story 100 times. You've looked at this regularly. You know about what's going on in the fiat monetary system. But your average person on the street really doesn't understand this. And so I, you know, this is why I've spent a lot of my free time trying to educate people and help them understand what Bitcoin is, because a shock is coming. It is very clear. And I think this is the thing that scares me the most, is the amount of people that didn't deserve this, that have worked hard their whole life, their whole career. And I explained it to my son the other day. I was like, basically, you've worked, you know, daddy's worked his whole life for little bits of paper, right? Mm-hmm. And there's one person who can get to print as much of that paper as they like, right? So essentially my paper becomes less and less valuable every year. You know, this 12-year-old kid, he understands it, was like, that sounds really unfair.
That sounds really stupid.
But, you know, the large majority of people don't understand what's going on. And I think something that happened in the last couple of months, which I thought was fantastic, was I think you saw perhaps Balaji on Twitter, the ex-CTO of Facebook. He put out what he tried to explain as the bit signal. Basically, his view is that the monetary system's about to collapse. Obviously, Silicon Valley was indicative of that. First Republic that we saw, obviously, recently is further indication of that. Credit Suisse, very painful within Switzerland for everybody. These are all signs of the coming collapse. And, you know, there's only a certain amount of time that this printing of money even is going to have an impact. And so what he wanted to do was put out a signal, bit signal, like the bat signal, to try and alert people that don't understand what's going on, that there is something bad happening and Bitcoin is the solution. And so what he did was he bet $1 million that Bitcoin would hit $1 million in 90 days.
Oh, wasn't it the CTO of Coinbase?
Oh, sorry, Coinbase.
Right, yeah. Okay, now I got you.
Yeah. Ex-CTO. Right. And so everybody, you know, is now paying attention. They're like, oh, what an idiot. Of course it's not going to get it. That's not the point. The point is that it could, right? We have a few more of these bank collapses and enough people realize, hang on a minute, where am I going to put my money? How am I going to store the value of my money? Bitcoin can go there. Mm-hmm. There's no reason why it can't. And that was the point he was trying to make. Now, I don't think he believes it's going to go there, because if he did, nope, he'd just spend $1 million buying Bitcoin, right? So the bet was really to send a signal. I thought mm-hmm. it was, obviously he's a rich guy, so he can do that. But mm-hmm. you know, it was a selfless act to throw $1 million away and just try and put out the message. And I actually think that he's really got a valid point. We as Bitcoiners have a responsibility to try and make sure that that message gets out there to as many people as possible before it's too late. Mm-hmm. And so even though I turn up to these barbecues and I'm met by, you know, Christine Lagarde says Bitcoin's bad, I'm like, you know, I have to bite my tongue and just go through the evening and try and slowly work the process of helping these people understand it. But, you know, sometimes you just give up. But, you know, I do think that we as Bitcoiners need to have a focus on this. We mm-hmm. need to be able to start to say, how can we send that bit signal to people? Mm. And I actually thought about something recently, and I wanted to talk to you about this because you're a Swiss guy, and you know, I'm recently in Switzerland. I don't really understand the Swiss construct, but you know, you have a very interesting system in Switzerland that you can have referendums, and if enough people sign a piece of paper saying we want to vote on something, then you can have that put forward as an official referendum that goes around the country and every single person in the country gets to vote on it.
Exactly.
So it's the closest thing to self-sovereignty and proper democracy, right?
It's almost like a BIP, a Bitcoin Improvement proposal. It's like that. Yeah. I think Switzerland as a country is organized very closely to how Bitcoin is organized in a democratic way. Mm. And what you say is exactly right. Like, everyone can come and say, I'll put on an initiative. If this person can collect 100,000 signatures, which is something that is feasible, I mean, there are 8 million people, and if you put some good money and power and the right people and the right organization behind you, can do that. And then it needs to go in front of these 8 million people and everyone can vote on it. And if they vote it in, plus 50%, it is law. Like, it can become law.
So I was thinking we could do one where we send a bit signal to the people of Switzerland and we say, we want to call a referendum that the Swiss National Bank starts printing money and buying Bitcoin with its balance sheet. Not a lot, but every year we could say a certain amount. But I don't think that the vote will go through. But the point is that it's our own equivalent of that bit signal, right? And you start to say, why on earth would anybody be wanting the central bank to buy Bitcoin, right? Bitcoin's a scam. Bitcoin's this. Bitcoin's that. I've heard all these terrible things about it. Christine Lagarde says it's terrible, right? But actually, you know, we can put out an explanation with it. It will definitely get some publicity. It'll start to get a bit more of a focus for people that have just ignored it to date.
Absolutely. I think it's going to be hard to influence the Swiss National Bank through politics because they are separated. There is actually a group of Bitcoiners that is already working since like for like 2 years now, working on the Swiss National Bank. Swiss National Bank is a private institution. You can buy shares. I actually own shares of the Swiss National Bank, and like at least 25, 30 other Bitcoiners in Switzerland I know. You can probably become a shareholder too. And once, if you have a group of 20 shareholders of the Swiss National Bank, they together can come up with such an initiative. And this initiative needs to be considered and added to the agenda of the General Assembly of the SNB. So the initiative was led by Lucius Meisser, the president of Bitcoin Swiss, and followed by 20 plus Bitcoiners. The year before, I think, and the initiative was clear, or the proposal was clear. We wanted the Swiss National Bank to prepare to buy Bitcoin. Don't have to commit to buy Bitcoin, but at least do the preparation. So if they want to, they can. They have the infrastructure in place. And then they basically said they already are. And so now I think I think tomorrow the next General Assembly is happening. I'm not going to be there, but I think the same group is going again. And I'm not sure if they will bring something up again. I'm not following it anymore. But this is being worked on by a group of people. I'm happy to introduce you to them. But that's a stream. That's one stream. Mm-hmm. And then the other stream can be through politics, but then it's more about law. If we want to create a new law or kind of send some other signal that is Bitcoin related, but I don't think that these actually, like the Federal Council, the highest political organ of Switzerland, cannot influence the SNB or the other way around. But both can be worked on. I would be super happy to continue this conversation.
Yeah, maybe we should think about ways. Because I was thinking that referendum process, you know, I got my first referendum voting form in the post. Like every single person in Switzerland gets one. So, you know, you can have a note about why we want to do whatever it is that we decide is the right thing to be doing.
Yeah. So we should definitely do that. You talked before about the problems that we are now facing in the fiat system. And I mean, you talked about the financial crisis. And I was still very young when the financial crisis happened in 2009. But then it was, I felt like it was a big, like, big thing in the media. Everyone is talking about it. Everyone's going crazy. People thought the world is going under and everything. And now we basically are witnessing the exact same thing on a larger scale. I mean, UBS, the biggest Swiss bank, has just been forced to buy the second biggest bank within a weekend without shareholder consent, just like that. And no one seems to really care. I mean, this is a huge thing, not only for Switzerland, but for the whole global financial system. Like, if something, like, it was obviously so urgent because Credit Suisse just was losing 120, 130 billion in asset under management per quarter. Like, it was such a crazy bank run going on. And we're seeing Silicon Valley Bank collapse, Silvergate Bank collapse, First Republic collapse. All these banks are collapsing, and it's happening at a scale that is bigger than Lehman Brothers at this point, which was the central theme in the financial crisis 15 years ago. And no one seems to really think that there's a big problem. I feel like we're in an even bigger storm than then, and I'm wondering why nobody seems to care.
So you've hit the nail on the head. There is the same and even bigger problem than we had with Lehman Brothers. But the difference is, and that's why you saw the same sort of level of panic very briefly that weekend with Silicon Valley Bank, because the Fed had to make a decision very quickly as to whether or not the FDIC was going to support all deposits. The minute that they made that decision to say unlimited deposit protection, that changed everything. Because suddenly you just had that buffer again in place obviously that whole stress through 2008 into 2009 was about whether or not the banks are going to get saved, because obviously Lehman had been let to go under.
Mm-hmm.
And so once you got that clarity that the banks were saved, the printing money was there and it wasn't going to stop, as Kashkari says, there's infinite dollars in the Fed. Once that was playing out, you know, people were like, okay, that's fine then. we're just going to roll into a massive sovereign debt crisis at some point in the future. Now, as we've talked about many times before, the way that you get out of a debt crisis is actually to let the debt fail, or devalue the money, or mm-hmm. go to a point of austerity that you can actually start to pay off the debt, i.e. balance your books. The point one and three are very difficult politically to manage, you know, to let the U.S. fail in their debt obligations, not going to happen, right? To then impose a level of austerity on the American people like the European Union did to the Greeks, not going to be accepted. So they do it by the sneaky backdoor road, which is just keep printing money until you devalue the money so much that the debt is of not a value. And that's what we're doing here.
But at the same time, they're also raising interest rates with the reasoning behind it that that they keep inflation in check.
Mm-hmm.
And that's also a big problem, right? Because for 10 years, we almost had after the financial crisis, we almost had the 0% policy in place. There was zero interest rates, so the market was flooded by money, and a lot of debt was kind of coming up. So there's now a lot of debt, sometimes like 10-year, 20-year debt, which is for free,
mm-hmm.
and all of a sudden, within like half a year, we go from zero to like 4% or 4.5% interest rate. So this debt, the new debt at least, becomes super expensive. And
yeah, and it's costing so much more than actually the U.S. is producing or actually spending on its entire military budget is the debt provision, the debt payment. But, you know, in that sort of small bubble of when we're going to be trying to fight inflation, there's going to be a narrative change, right, where they start to say, okay, maybe we can accept 4% inflation.
Yeah.
And it's just going to keep going in this direction. The world is naturally deflationary. A lot of what we're seeing in technology improvements and even in energy efficiency should be reducing the price of things. But because of the debasement of the money, you're going to see inflation persist for a longer period of time.
Mm.
And, you know, they're going to just keep printing the money to pay that coupon. So they can keep the interest rate high, but continue to print money to pay off that interest rate.
But it's going to be a problem, a big problem for the banks. And because that's exactly the problem that First Republic has now, that they have almost $200 billion in outstanding credit that is very cheap. So they almost earn nothing mm-hmm. out of the... And that's the only business model a bank has, right? They give out money and they earn interest.
Exactly.
They pay less to their debtors. But now they almost earn nothing on their credits mm-hmm. and they have to pay a couple of percent, way more than they are earning to their customers. So obviously they're making huge book losses, mm-hmm. and that's why they lost 95% in their stock this year. And for every bank is exactly the same. No?
Well, yeah, the problem is that they're locked into these lower interest rates in the bonds that they essentially invested in. So they can't pay those higher rates of interest to their depositors. So depositors are all leaving for the latest Apple account with 4.15%
right,
interest or
right.
a money market fund, and that's what's happening. Oh. So major deposits are now just moving out the bank. That's why you're getting these bank runs.
Yeah.
So even up until, you know, a month before Silicon Valley Bank, I think Chase was paying 0.05% on their main checking account.
Yeah.
So it's just like...
Oh, so that's now...
That's what's triggering the bank
Apple
run.
Is basically now attacking the banks.
I don't know if you could position it like that, but what Apple is doing is putting the banks in a very bad position. Apple's not the only one offering a very high deposit rate account. You can get access to these interest rates via money market funds, via short-term bond markets. So, you know, that's what's happening. A lot of these, you know, particularly these Silicon Valley companies, are saying, okay, we can't keep our bank, our deposits in these banks now that aren't paying. We need to get a bit more serious about how we manage our cash. So, you know, you're seeing those bank deposits leave. But but more and more that's happening on an individual level as well. You know, people don't want to sit there and know that they're paying 7% on their mortgage or 6.5% on their mortgage and they're getting zero in their bank account.
So, yeah, I mean, in a rational world where we have in Switzerland 3.5% inflation, we should get like 4% inflation, interest rates at least, which we're not like far away from that. We're getting still less than 1%.
Yeah.
And so in other countries, like in European countries, it's even worse. You get 8 to 10% inflation, you get 1% interest rate. So that's why I think, do you feel like that's also the reason why a lot of people start to realize this problem and see Bitcoin as a solution?
Well, that's just it. I mean, you're getting devaluation of your savings, right? Just in the difference between what you can earn on those savings and the inflation rate. So it's that energy leakage. Right, that we talk about in any financial product other than Bitcoin, because Bitcoin is a closed system and it's 21 million Bitcoin, right? And that's it. It's fixed.
What do you think is going to happen in around about 1 year from now when we see the next halving?
I spent a lot of time thinking about what might happen as we run into. I think you know, investors and traders don't always let the same pattern play out because they've seen the pattern play out and they trade the pattern, right? So if you always know that you're going to see a rally post-halving because of the supply cut, you're going to trade into that. So we should, and I thought we were going to see it last cycle, but we didn't. We should see a front running of the halving.
Already now.
Starting to play out, right? The fact, And the good indicator of that should be that we should be probably above the recent all-time high. So let's call it 60,000, right? You should imagine that post-halving, you're going to get to 60,000 pretty quickly. So people should start to think about making that trade. But I think the volatility of Bitcoin, the unpredictability of the things going on around it, along with the banking system as well, means that you just can't get comfortable with doing a trade like that for that long. So it'll probably take some time for us to get to that point, and volatility in Bitcoin has to decrease. But more and more you'll see, I think, the price sort of just normalizing to a steady uptrend, and you'll get rid of these bumps around the halving.
Okay.
Because traders trade the inefficiency, right? You can't consistently have something that will trade down here pre-halving and then up here post-halving for every single time it happens. Because we used to do that in the investment bank. We used to do, well, in every World Cup, you know, we'd create a basket of stocks and how they would perform for the underlying country. And you could say these stocks will outperform. And so everyone would just do those trades. And that sort of means that the efficiency or the arbitrage gets diminished. Right, and that is an arbitrage, but it's an arbitrage that's got time in between it. So you are taking risk over that period that, you know, an FTX or a Mt. Gox release, or, you know, US government sale, whatever it might be, that could potentially depress the price of Bitcoin for a period, could impact it. So it's always about the timing.
Yeah, and we did see this already when we went up from like 30K to 60K in a short period of time. And then, boom, what came in was the China ban on mining. That was obviously depressing the price a lot. And then we kind of got out of this and had another bull run, as you said, another bull run that was coming. And boom, what happens is FTX and again depressed. So do you think that we're kind of still in play of a big bull run? It's just going to be, it's just being stopped by external factors all the time.
Yeah, we're definitely going to have a big bull run.
Look at the smile on his face.
I couldn't be more convinced. Yeah, it's going to come. You know, with we just talked about all the backdrop of what's going on in the fiat monetary landscape, and if you can make sure that you know enough people are starting to understand the problem and where the solution lies, then more and more people are going to flock to Bitcoin. I mean, you run a company that every single week you're seeing new inflows.
Mm.
You're seeing new people come on, set up accounts, go, I want to be buying Bitcoin on a regular basis.
Mm-hmm.
And this sort of stacking army of Bitcoiners is really helping us trend into where we're eventually going to go. It's just, you know, making sure that as many people understand that early as possible, mm-hmm. so that the people that need it most don't get left behind.
Mm-hmm.
That's always my concern. Like, so, you know, after you and I met in 2022, I actually went out to Costa Rica and spent time with the Bitcoin Jungle guys to actually help people on the ground in Costa Rica actually understand what Bitcoin is, how they can use it, how it can actually protect their savings. Didn't particularly help that Bitcoin then crashed a few months afterwards, but, you know, I'm still in touch with a few of those people and send them some sats to compensate for what they lost. But I think, you know, if you look at the supply dynamics of where we are now, I think we've got about 2.3 million Bitcoin. We were on exchanges around this time 4 years ago. So if we're talking in halvings, you had 2.3 million Bitcoin on exchanges at this time exactly 4 years ago. Today, you've probably got about 2 million Bitcoin on exchanges. Okay, so already the supply has dropped.
Mm-hmm.
We're going into a supply drop. But it's important to note that over that four-year period, we saw another 2 million Bitcoin be issued by the network.
Right.
So 2.3 million Bitcoin have been taken out of major liquid supply in the last 4 years. And then you've got, going forward, about 1.7 million Bitcoin ever to be issued.
Still to be mined, yeah.
Yeah. So we've taken out of liquid supply 2.3 million in the last 4 years. We've only got 1.7 left, and there are 2 million on exchanges. So we're getting into a position where the supply of Bitcoin is going to do what potentially Balaji talked about. I mean, we're going to have a significant price rip in Bitcoin
mm-hmm.
At some point. I don't know when. I'm not going to make a three-month bet, but it's coming.
Because it's going to be a liquidity crunch at one point, right? If all the Bitcoin in circulation are not really in circulation, but they're in hodler wallets. Like, I'm not letting... I have some amount on my hardware wallet. I'm not letting go of them. And many are like me, right? So most of these Bitcoin that are already being mined are not left on exchange to trade, so like liquid. But most of them are actually just in hardware wallets and they stay there. And less and less of them are newly being issued. At one point, it's just going to be super expensive to buy one, right? Because no one wants to sell. Yeah. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, what I'm saying is we're walking into a really bad supply dynamic for Bitcoin, which is really positive for the price because that's where your elasticity comes, right, is in the price because there's no elasticity in the underlying supply, right? It's fixed.
Wow. That's super bullish. You are super bullish. So my last question then would be for you. How much of your total wealth do you store in Bitcoin in terms of like percentage?
You made a comment earlier that I'm obviously a very wealthy guy and I could retire. I'm not as wealthy as that and I couldn't retire. So yeah, definitely need to be working. I think, look, I'm going to avoid the question. I try and make sure that I help people understand what they should be thinking in terms of their allocation, and it does depend on how much money you have because you need to be able to stay liquid. You need to be able to meet your obligations, your rent, etc. And so it's really a factor of that, and it's also a factor of your understanding. You can't expect a guy that you just met at a barbecue to move from zero to a 20% allocation. It's just not going to happen.
Mm.
So I think it's always an education process and people understanding their risk profile, but also their liquidity requirements, which is another reason why we created the fund, right? Because as a Bitcoiner, you don't ever want to have to sell your Bitcoin at all, but... You don't ever want to have to sell it at a point where things are going really badly for Bitcoin, right? If you were having to sell because you needed to, you know, buy a house or buy a car or whatever it was that you specifically needed to be buying at that point when Bitcoin was trading at 15,000, you're not feeling very good about yourself right now. And that's the point of the fund, is really so that you've got liquidity in a product that's related to the underlying asset, but you're not going through those dips. That's what we're really targeting. I'm not saying that the fund will never lose money, but the focus is to make sure that you have protection in those drawdowns. So in a year like 2022, we're looking at making somewhere between 5 and 15% on the fund. Now, if you're down 65% in your Bitcoin, you have a liquidity situation where you need to pay for something and you have to sell your Bitcoin, that's a terrible situation to be in. So this is why we created the fund in this way, and we also created it as a monthly liquidity product, so you can get your money out within a month, which is much more liquid than your traditional hedge fund, which is normally quarterly, so every 3 months. And that's really what it's designed to do. It's almost like your piggy bank, which is exposed to crypto, but is not necessarily going to be having the painful drawdowns.
That makes total sense. Thank you very much, Richard, for coming by. It was really a pleasure. I learned a lot. It was really valuable lessons that you shared with us. Thank you very much for taking the time, and have a great rest of your day, and talk soon.
Julian, thanks for having me. It was brilliant.
Cheers, guys.
Cheers.